It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch and a team of top writing talent.
A stinging Atlantic rain pelts the old wooden structures at Mortlake with full-throated clatter. Dr. D glances at the meandering streams on his windows, taking his mind off the impending meeting with the young Warwickshire playwright. Shakespeare will be arriving shortly. His third visit. Here, in the Externa Bibliotheca, where D receives guests, he intends to convince the young lad to give up London and follow him to Illyria. The library is what the boy is after, but the library, and certainly the precious volumes of the Interna Bibliotheca, shall not be travelling abroad. So the strategy will be to convince Master Shakespeare that access to the librarian is more valuable. A tenuous thesis. D has formulated stratagems. His own life has taught him that no desire resonated so much in the mind of man as the envious desire to feel superior to competitors. Human society has an instinctive tendency to admire any man who has distinguished himself, jealously craving to better that singular person. Only slightly acquainted with the competitive life of London's theatre world, D knew of the petty feuds playwrights waged with pamphlets and parodies published to shame each other. Green objected to Nash. Nash reviled Kidd. Kidd reviled Chapman. And everyone was envious of Kit Marlowe. D hoped Will would accept his offer to tutor him in all the arts and sciences, and in return, Shakespeare would clerk for him. It was, after all, the rare opportunity of private instruction with a renowned scholar. Princess Elizabeth had had cheek. Now Will would have universally esteemed scholar Dr. John Dee. What patrons and inner circles might not a young man penetrate if he had the same mentor as the Duke of Northumberland, the Earl of Leicester, or Sir Philip Sidney? Moreover, all London knows that I have the Queen's ear, even if I do not have her purse. As the nearby church bell rings out, three high-heeled boots approach along the wooden stairway that leads to his well-appointed study. The lad is punctual, Dee thinks, and there is undeniable excitement in his hurried march toward the door. In a moment, the author of Prince Amleth has come knocking. Enter. The boy is uncomfortably wet, cold and expectant, careful not to drip on anything. A shivering Shakespeare crosses the threshold. A good morrow to you, Doctor. As you can see, despite the elements, I have returned. You're as wet as a hen. Stand by the hearth. Will flings a curtain of rain from his sleeve toward the fireplace. It was an evil ferrying from Southwark. I had much ado to keep the chill from my bones. He gives a quick glance out the one window. It rains cats and dogs. Gingerly, he begins to unbutton.
Another classic Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting.
The Queen's Conjurer, Dr. John Dee, is an Elizabethan mathematician, cryptographer and mystic, commissioned by Her Majesty's spymaster, Lord Walsingham, to suss out a noble count who governs an island in the English Channel. Dee's mission, uncover treason, reveal terrorists and unveil threats to the crown. Embarking, Dr. Dee is accosted by an eager acolyte, the unknown teen playwright William, has just endured his first flop, Prince Amleth. Will solicits the renowned scholar's mentorship. A winter tide sees these unlikely collaborators set sail for the Channel Islands to sleuth out sedition on Protestant England's strategic outpost. On Illyria, clues appear as Dee comes to rely on the surprising ingenuity of his young companion. Clandestine powers collide as Queen Elizabeth's spy tracks H. Slim Lead. When Dee is brought to the brink of destruction, can his incipient discovery of Count Orsino's recusants and loyalists be thwarted? Well, there's the descriptor of Betrayal of Angels, this month's Book of the Month, by Armin Shimerman. And in a slight change to the normal routine, of course, we haven't got Jenny Finch to cast her eagle eye over the whole thing, but we do have regular Rob Nichols, of course, writer, author, historian, and indeed huge fan of Middlesbrough Football Club, who's obviously sort of celebrating in the presence of Martin Darroon and Martin Braithwaite, who are ex-Borough players who are doing things for other countries in the European Championship. Yeah. Rob, book of the month.
Oh, yeah.
We've had a couple of clips with respect to obviously the sort of breakdown of this particular piece.
Yes.
But what did you make of Betrayal of Angels?
It's an interesting concept, isn't it? In that, as far as I know, that very little is known about the person, William Shakespeare, is it? Isn't it? And Dr. D is, for me, is a little bit of a figure that I know a little bit more about because of the not that long ago there at Manchester Festival, Damon Albarn of Blur brought together a show about Dr. D, and he's a very interesting character because in some ways he's a sort of many aspects of what he does you can relate to in the 21st century, but then there's other things that he does that sort of mystical, occult, that you would think a completely divorced or a different world, a very medieval, whatever. But one thing this book does show, it brings it all into the round. It shows how everything in his mind is linked together. And it's a really great idea that he takes the young William Shakespeare, who's come from the provinces. You always wonder, where did he get all this incredible store of knowledge from? And he's picking it up of Dr. D and his incredible library and his incredible brain, and also going on an experience and adventure with him, which brings him out into the world and lets him experience all these things firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I was very impressed with this particular novel. I've made it clear to Armin Schumerman, who is in many ways one of our own. Here we are, you see him behind him, holding, of course, William Shakespeare in his hand. But of course, best known to many people, either as Principal Snyder in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or indeed Quark in the Star Trek series Deep Space Nine, or indeed many other sort of incarnations. But he is a self-confessed Shakespeareophile. And very keen. And in fact, he's almost, I think at times he said he was a little bit embarrassed about, you know, an American in California or in Los Angeles writing about obviously something which is so English in terms of its take. Yeah. But I think he's done extremely well. And I do like the way in which he's used his scholarship to get a kind of rhythm to the prose, which can be a bit challenging to get into initially because you think, oh, fut, where are we going on with respect to this? Yeah. What sort of things are actually happening? I mean, just a sort of example of he shakes his head. No, he must keep his wits about him. She smiles at his lack of social ease. Master, shake a spear. The Countess continues to mispronounce his name, which he never wishes to correct. So taken is he with her broken pronunciation. Your sentiments and your poesy have provided much delight for my husband. He hath known you but a brief time, and already you are no étranger to his happiness. You are like to be much advanced. Obviously, looking at the Countess there when they encounter the Franca file sort of notions of the whole thing. I think one of the things that the book does address very effectively is that sense of separateness, which people are understandably hopeful will never return in terms of our own history, which from the advent really of Henry VIII and then obviously Elizabeth and the whole anti-papist, anti-Catholic, Protestant sort of line really kind of shows that the paranoia, if you like, of somebody like John Dee, who literally obviously wants to thrive for himself and his family, but doesn't really know whether he's got the court's favor, whether he only goes off on the spy mission basically because he's kind of inveigled and cajoled into doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, I think bringing on board Shakespeare into that line and obviously the sort of switch that you've got there, I think works really very effectively. It's also nice, I think, to see a number of ways in which Shakespearean themes and plays, including obviously The Tempest and the whole notion of Prospero and other areas within that, are woven into the actual writing. I found that really quite interesting.
Yeah, I've got to admit, Alex, that's where I fall down. I don't know as much about Shakespeare as I should, but yeah, it's
he's only one of Britain's greatest playwrights, Rob.
And obviously drawing on incredible historical store of knowledge for those plays, I just don't know them in great detail, but yes, it does bring out the fact that the Elizabethan England, which is always harked back to as a golden age, it was on a knife edge, wasn't it? And We'd only recently had Bloody Mary on the throne, her sister. You're suddenly challenged in this century as to which religion you follow, and you've got you throw your all into one religion, and then a new monarch comes to the throne, and suddenly you're in the bad books, and being in the bad books means you probably lose your head or at least lose your position, lose everything. You're walking a tightrope, because like Dr. D, he has, like so many of them, they were born Catholic. And they suddenly have to be Protestant and totally disowning everything to do with Catholicism, and obviously their past is going to be brought up by people who want to do them down. And we know from Elizabeth's time that the spymasters were played a massive part, and they continue to in her successor James I. Of course, Mary Queen of Scots gets caught out ultimately. When a letter is discovered, and there was a lot of coding going on, so Dr. D would be absolutely perfect for this role, because they had quite sophisticated coding in this century, and we're in the lead up to the Armada, which remember is Philip of Spain's. He's an incredibly religious man. And he almost feels it's some sort of divine mission to invade England and replace, put himself on the throne, but change the religion. We've got excommunications going backwards and forwards all the time as well. And we've got the battle between London and the papacy in Rome, and we've got this little island in the Channel Islands. It's trying to play its own game, really. And it's in a very vulnerable position. Obviously, it's a lot closer to the European coast than it is to ours. But it's trying to be in the middle, and John Dee's going to try and find out which side they're really on, really, and who they're really helping.
I mean, certainly, Illyria is the work of fiction. It's the sort of slight sort of aspect. The island itself doesn't actually exist. Yeah. Although I think it's fair to say that we're seeing Guernsey. It as a kind of Guernsey, Jersey, somewhere close to obviously the coast. So there are issues that relate to that. I'll stick with the review that I actually gave on Amazon after reading the text. And it's rare I actually do put a review on Amazon, even though the whole thing will insist on actually sort of saying, please leave a review, etc. I just feel I don't want to be dominated into this, but I'll say this. Just a short line. A magical odyssey for the ages, a thoroughly enthralling, captivating text which overflows with narrative delights, guaranteed to captivate readers and literary historians of all generations. Maybe I was perhaps... over effluent in terms of the praise there, but I don't know. I do know, Rob, of course, that the worst thing for any of your texts that you actually look for us with respect to Book of the Month, etc., is when you actually reach the end of the piece itself and you see "to be continued" in Illyria Book 2. It makes you so annoyed.
It does. I didn't know whether to bring this up because is it the ultimate spoiler? It does tell you that it's book one at the start. But I really like, if it's a series of books, to be a kind of discreet adventure or a discreet story in a way. And I like the idea of that you could join the second book without reading the first book, perhaps. But just the idea I feel as if this could be like. Could be 10 parts for all I know. It just, it could be, there's no way of knowing.
To be fair, I think, again, as you said, it is going to be a trilogy. I think it's been intended that you could wait until you get all three. But I do feel as though actually the setup of this, and no major spoilers apart from the fact that there is a kind of cliffhanger-ish ending. You do get, I think the characters are very well defined. I think the as you said, Shakespeare, very much to the fore there, John Dee, the quest that they go on, the journey that they actually go on, the world building, if you use a science fiction sort of aspect, is actually really effective, because I did feel as though actually because of the language, because of the speech, because of the way that things were put into place there, that we were transported into that particular 16th century era. Now, it may well be that's a complete conceit, and it was absolutely nothing like that. At the same time, there was this sense that actually, yeah, we kind of revere Shakespeare now as this fantastic, great wordsmith. And yet, how did he actually sort of, you know, what were his experiences? Where that sort of came from. And of course, John Dee is somebody who, as you said, Damon Albarn produced an operetta 2012 or so with respect to that. So he's kind of come back into fashion. People have been expressing interest about his line as an alchemist, as somebody who, not unlike Erasmus, really wanted to actually understand all knowledge in a time pre-internet, pre-web, where you couldn't just actually sort of hit your particular device and find out things about other lands and so on, but did have that kind of passion for learning at the same time as obviously being caught, as you rightly said, between the proverbial rock and a hard place. And you mentioned excommunication. It's probably difficult at this stage in the 21st century to just state how frightening that actually was, because you'd be effectively cast into Hades for all time. Your soul had no form of redemption and so on. And this was at a time where obviously mortality and issues related to that were obviously there. I mean, we were coming into the Enlightenment. We were beginning to sort of see the ways in which things were changing. Let's just hope that Brexit doesn't serve a similar sort of pattern, really.
Well, you say about mortality, and John Dee's treated constantly through this book as an old man, and he's in his late 40s, isn't he? I was really interested by that, and I suddenly started googling lots of people, because I knew that Queen Elizabeth, she's the Queen obviously, but she lived to be about 70, I think, and there's quite a lot of other people, major figures that did live quite a bit longer. But yeah, it's really interesting that idea that he's a respected or disrespected old man in his 40s and constantly complaining about his joints and things like that. And there were other interesting things about where he was living. He wasn't. I love the way that they talk about describe the journey to London, and he doesn't live a vast distance away. But yet, obviously, in terms of the 16th century, he could go by water, but he went over land, and it's not a particularly comfortable journey. And what did it take, a whole day or something like that?
You can get from Mortlake to Waterloo in about 20 minutes basically by train,
lots of interesting aspects, like where they go aboard the ship, and the crew of the ship who were basically operating out of the Dutch territories, aren't they, which themselves are just emerging from different empires. And they've got a bit of freedom of practice because they're Jewish, aren't they? But they're able to practice from there. But wherever they go in the world, they're kind of shunned or whatever.
There's certainly the notion of anti-Semitism is actually brought in there. And I think that there are a number of issues that make fascinating reading in terms of the way it actually develops. I would actually counsel anybody who's might be put off initially by sort of the first few pages, dive into the whole thing, get through the first 50 or 60 pages, and then it begins to, once you kind of connect with the text, I think it works on that side of things. Because initially, I think that the way in which we're introduced to Shakespeare and so on, you think, I'm not sure where we're going here. I don't know if you found that, Rob.
There was a lot of big names from history suddenly coming into things. But as you said, the style is very, very easy to read. And it does feel like an amalgam of old English, but very, very readable. It doesn't put you off in any way. And you soon, very rapidly can work your way through it and understand everything.
And any particular characters resonate with yourself? I mean, are you sticking with John Dee? Is it a case of Shakespeare? A bit like sort of Shakespeare's Robin to John Dee's Batman, basically, although maybe 47 is far too old.
It's John Dee that I like. Obviously, he, when we see him as a tutor, he's terrible. He's a terrible sort of bad-tempered tutor, and you wouldn't really want to choose him as you to be teaching your lessons, because he's very, very strict. And if he's in a bad mood that day, then you're going to be in trouble. But John Dee's just he feels he could be. It's the great sort of optimist that he feels that he could be on the end of cracking the code for the world, really, of the way the universe and the world works, and he feels it's within reach, and that's what you're talking about, the enlightenment, the age of reason. That for the first time, people thought everything was possible. There could be explanations. And that's why alchemy is all tied up in that, because everything's coming back to numbers and to elements and everything. And as I say, every possibility seems on the cards, doesn't it? On the table, really.
And again, we have, I suppose, comparable folk, not that they were spies, of course, Albert Einstein, the likes of Stephen Hawking. I think each generation has its own sort of folk who will connect and work within that. Okay,
Isaac Newton after John Dee, of course, and Isaac Newton also dabbled in the alchemy as well, which is
hugely so. I mean, it's often little known. People think about Isaac Newton, say, "Oh, fine, yes, physics, laws of momentum, and so on." But he was fascinated by decoding the scriptures, decoding the words, working on that system. Again, it is a kind of extraordinary aspects to actually sort of delve into, which again we've looked at. Okay, we may well be hearing from another one of our Book of the Month readers before the programme actually ends. But at this moment in time, Rob, it's time for me to actually ask you, as ever, because Jenny obviously isn't with us for this one, Armin Shimerman, the first book, Illyria, what is your score for Betrayal of Angels?
I'm going to go for 8 out of 10.
And I think I will go for an 8 as well, over all things considered. I mean, I know I gave it a 5-star rating, but I think initially, when one evaluates all the sort of aspects of that, I think an 8 is a good solid line from that. Next month, we might well be having a couple of options for the sort of system. We may well be looking at The Wonderment of Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman, which was produced a few years ago now, or indeed looking at a major political satire by Evgeny Gridnev called The Stink in the Tale. One or both of those will be duly considered when we welcome back Jenny, obviously, to technically it's her show. It is.
Yeah.
Book of the Month. The policy discussion that day is rather one-sided. Curio is a played man, which is why Orsino trusts him. Instead of a brilliant schemer who is too clever by half, it is better to choose a friend of the more everyday sort who, when it is needed, ventures common sense advice. He has Lord Griffin for brilliant scheming. Orsino believes that Curio is a man who does what is expected by his liege lord rather than follow his own bent. That is the success of their relationship. The two men grew up as companions. It is said that in their youth, the old count's son and his comrade had both striven to outdo each other in the service of Venus, but Curio turned modest and subservient when Orsino became governor of Illyria. And when the old count Orsino died, both young men had reformed their debauched lifestyles almost overnight, and now think only to serve Illyria. It was Curio who went to France to woo the young French princess to be his friend's wife. It was Curio who culled the best men in Illyria for Orsino's advisers. And as the household well knows, it is Curio, an expert at listening, who is best capable of forestalling his master's choleric outbursts. The household swears Curio can read Orsino's thoughts before God can. As they wait for Tyne to bring Orsino's wardrobe, the Count intensely lectures his friend on the English vulnerability to the Spanish war machine, disdaining the doddering Elizabeth. Curio, his head cocked to one side in a servile but forthright pose mastered long ago, gently reminds his lordship that it is best not to underestimate the English Machiavels. They have outwitted the French diplomats' dozens of assassination attempts, Spanish and French statesmanship to draw England into foreign wars, and the excommunication by the Pope, all while the English economy flourishes. The Queen's age, Curio argues politely, is a testament to her political savvy and endurance. She is no Henry VII, nor Cromwell, yet her Burleigh may be. His point made, Curio's posture returns to his natural subservient slouch. Orsino nods. Long and faithful friend, he says, playfully throwing the brush at Curio. You are the wiser. Curio goes on to suggest that Lord Griffin be informed of Illyria's new visitor, with Orsino acknowledging the wisdom in that. The debonair Edmund de Trees, Lord Griffin, though only 30 years old, is the Chamberlain of Illyria's Privy Council and well-versed in policy and protocol. When Davar returns with the robes, Ofsino sends word through him that Griffin is to be by his side in the Great Chamber and that he should wear his sword of state. All must dress in their best finery to bedazzle Elizabeth's old but newcome civil servant. The Comte desires there to be reams of communiques back to Whitehall, praising Illyrian lavishness.
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
As promised, we do actually have the thoughts of Jessica Burtis on Illyria. And this is your turn, Jessica, to share with us on Book of the Month your thoughts about Armin Shimerman's novel.
Thank you. I'm so excited. So this is actually something that is typically out of my reading comfort zone. I tend to stay within more modern language, I should say. So that's actually my first question for Armin. I was super curious about how he went about writing it in this more classic style with an older type of language. That was what stuck out to me from the very beginning. And I think went through the whole book is that kind of Elizabethan way of talking. And I kind of had to look up words to understand some of them. And it just made the whole experience that much more immersive. And I am just very curious about how Armin went about building these characters, because now I'm super interested in these figures from history. I think we're all very familiar with William Shakespeare, but John Dee is someone who I didn't know about, but now he's fascinating me after having read about him. And I would love to know how he went about kind of trying to like meet these historical people and build up their lives within this book. And I'm looking forward to this second book. I'm really hoping I want to get the copies in paperback so I can have them looking very nice on my bookshelf and can hopefully share them with my parents. So I am so excited about this book series because it's something that I'm not used to reading. And I think that it's such a unique experience kind of reading about these historical figures in a way that I don't think I would have imagined. And I'm very impressed that Armin did this. So it's absolutely beautiful. I think my third question was how he went about writing this in such a kind of film-like way. Because when I was reading it, it read like a film. Like I could just picture it in my head as images. And I thought that was kind of unique about this writing style because it didn't quite feel like a typical narrative. It felt like I was watching a film and it was being described to me. And some of the images were so rich. And I felt like the whole thing was just like a painting. I think that's part of what impressed me. So I'm very curious if this was a writing style that he had to develop or if it was something that just came naturally from his work on television.
I think three very important points there, which hopefully when we connect again with Armin, we will actually put to him. Obviously, we've just heard Rob Nichols' views on the whole thing, and we both went for 8 out of 10 for the actual score for the book. Fascinating lines. What's your score, Jessica, for Illyria Book 1, of course, in the projected trilogy of John Dee and so on?
I was going to go for a 9 out of 10. I really want to read the next copy, and it just impressed me because I really would not have gone into it expecting to like it as much as I did, just because it's something out of the ordinary for me to read, but I ended up really enjoying it. Like every page was interesting to me.
Well, hopefully, as I say, Armin may well listen to this, so be interested in getting that connection together. And I've got to say, I do agree. My tip basically for people who, like yourself, found the initial register in which the book is expressed mm-hmm. and the language that's being used is dive in. By the time you get through the first 40, 50 pages,
yeah,
you immerse yourself in that world and you suddenly actually start getting it in terms of how the processes are worked and transpired. I'll put the other question to you, which we spoke about with respect to Rob. Did you have any favourite characters who sprang to mind and burst from the page?
John Dee. I have never heard of him. I remember you guys were all talking about him before and I was like, who is this person? What are we talking about? Talking to angels? Like what's going on? And then actually getting to read it, I was immediately like, oh my goodness, I need to know more about this person who I've never heard of, but just sounds so interesting. I love any kind of like thing like that, like not quite a cult, but like, you know, kind of otherworldly studies. And Yeah, I thought that he was the most interesting character for that reason. And he is the one that I could just picture in my head. So that would be definitely my favorite character. Who is yours? Can I know? Can I know before I listen to the recording?
I quite like the Dutch captain. I thought the Dutch captain on the steamship was well articulated. And certain elements, I think, of William Shakespeare or Shakespeare also had a sort of a chime with me. But again, they were all well put together. And again, I think it's a three thumbs up from yourself, Rob Nichols, and myself for obviously this month's Book of the Month. Again, we're heading off into probably the world of Neil Gaiman for the next one, when Jenny Finch will be back with us and we'll hopefully connect on that side of things, in which, Jessica, we go to Neverwhere.
Ooh, I'm very excited.
Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting, podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.